from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Montgomery, sitting in for Michael Krasny. In less than 20 years, California has gone from having nearly the highest juvenile incarceration rate in the country to having one of the lowest. We talk with criminal justice expert Dan McAleer about the radical shift in the state's approach to youth corrections. His new book, After the Doors Were Locked, traces the often brutal history of California's youth correction system and the various attempts to reform it, from the Gold Rush to today. That's coming up next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Montgomery, sitting in for Michael Krasny. In 1996, California had 10,000 youth locked up in state-run detention facilities, basically prisons for young people. Today, that number is around 700. And with crime rates still at historic lows, the job of dealing with young offenders increasingly is falling to the counties. That's a good thing, according to Dan McAleer. He's executive director of the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice and the author of After the Doors Were Locked, A History of Youth Corrections in California. Dan McAleer, welcome back to Forum.
Thank you, Michael, for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you. I want to start with the situation today. There does seem to be, dare I say, a fair amount of good news. As we said, crime is low. There's a lower number of people incarcerated, especially young people. I can only assume that this is a moment you've been waiting for a long time.
In many ways, it's a moment I've never really thought would come. Since 1996, we've seen an unprecedented decline in the number of kids held in state-run youth correctional facilities. The population has fallen from 10,000 to roughly about 700 today. Back in 1996, we had 11 large institutions called reform schools. We now have three. And the question right now is, where do we go from here?
And it's something you have some strong views on.
I do, as many other people do.
And so with the progress, you are not completely satisfied. And one of the positions you have, and you do articulate this in the book, is the idea that the state of California really should get out of the business of incarcerating young people and really leave it completely to the counties.
Well, the concern I have really goes back to the treatment of kids, the historical treatment of kids within the institutional settings. The institutions we have today are the institutional model that is widely practiced within our youth correction system here in California and, frankly, around most of the country, really is rooted in the 19th century.
Which is what your book really is all about, history.
I think it was important to point that out because a lot of times when we think about the current problems that exist and are manifested within the current institutions, we think it's a modern problem. It's not. It has its origins back over 100 years ago. And it's important to point out to people that the juvenile justice system, and specifically in my case, the youth correction system, has its origins in the penitentiary system, the adult penitentiary system. And these institutions for kids were built in response to society placing these young people back in the early 19th century in these adult prisons, recognizing that it was foolhardy, that it was a bad idea. And so that's when social reformers got around to developing the idea of a new type of institution. And in many cases, in the early days, in the early 19th century, they called it penitentiaries for young people. So the concept was deeply embedded, deeply ingrained in our psychology, and it's really dominated youth correctional policy really since the 1820s.
And there's a sort of tension in your book, and this is kind of essential to your arguments about what we should do today, and that is between these large institutions, prison-like institutions, And the sort of alternative approach is smaller scale that offer more individualized treatment.
Yes.
And there was this dichotomy going back to the, actually, as you write in your book, going back to the early 1900s between, remind me, what were known as the houses of refuge.
Yes.
And the cottage system.
Yes.
And the idea against was partly one of scale.
Yes, yes. Much of the early policy debates around youth corrections, particularly in the 19th century, and I want to point out that the current system has its roots in the 19th century. There is a direct relationship of the events between the events that occurred in the 19th century and how the system is structured today. So initially, we had what were called houses of refuge. They were developed in the 1820s and continued really until the 1850s. And these were called designed along what was called back then congregate institutions. Sounds like a horrible word, but basically, these were prison-like designs. These were institutions that were intended to efficiently manage large numbers of kids in a very structured, very regimented environment. And of course, as we found out, the only way you do that, the only way at least they could envision maintaining control over large numbers of kids in institutions was through the use of very harsh punishments, strict enforcement of rules, and it led to horrible abuses. Now,
and this concept, sorry to interrupt.
Sure.
And this concept basically is the model for the creation of the San Francisco Industrial School in the 1950s.
Correct.
This is the 1850s.
Yeah.
This is the first institution of its kind opened in California.
That is correct. The congregate institution was the congregate institutional design was a term that was applied to the adult penitentiaries. San Quentin was called a congregate institution. It was also applied to the San Francisco Industrial School, and it was applied by most social commentators of the day to most youth facilities and youth institutions in the 19th century and into the 20th century, right up till today.
Now, there are, I have to say, a lot of shocking moments in your book.
Yeah.
You write about this industrial school, which to me gave me images from Oliver Twist or something like that, where the young people
yeah.
are growing the food. They're doing everything to make this place run.
Yeah.
And there is an idea here, or thing that you talk about, which is a lot of these young people weren't actually convicted of any kind of crime.
Correct. Yeah.
And they had constitutional at the time, really no real constitutional protections. It's really chilling.
Well, it's interesting because all of these institutions in the 19th century were established for the specific purpose, the expressed purpose of helping children, saving children who were out wandering the streets, who were the victims of abusive, neglectful parents, absent parents, parents who weren't, you know, who were still alive. They were, otherwise, they'd be in orphanages. But it was established as institutions somewhere between that would handle kids, remove kids from the streets who fell between the orphan and the criminal, the confirmed criminal. And so they were kind of looked at as preventive institutions. And the idea was the kids would be removed from the streets. They would be placed in this kind of benign institution. And the institutions would imbue them with proper work habits. That was the primary goal of the early institutions, instill them with work habits, instill a healthy fear of God, using religion as a path to virtue. And at the same time, offer some type of elementary education. Now, in the 1850s, what happens is there's a societal change, and we start to move to the idea of public education and later compulsory education. Compulsory education begins in the 1850s, and so that kind of changes the equation. And so then what we have, we move from institutions called houses of refuge, and that term disappears after the 1850s. And we move to the idea of reform schools or industrial schools or training schools, institutions with the name schools in them, but pretty much the same reality.
We're talking about the juvenile justice system in California with Dan McAleer. He's executive director of the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice and the author of After the Doors Were Locked, A History of Youth Corrections in California, and A Troubling History. And I have to ask you, you talk, of course, about the ideal being it was a benign situation, but far from it. And you document what you call corporal punishment against boys and girls. I would think today we could call it torture, right. Flogging and of the boys with these thick leather whips, and what was called for the girls the water cure.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, the water cure was you basically you place a girl, you strip her down. You place her under a hose and you spray her with cold water. It was not an uncommon punishment in 19th century prisons.
And you leave her often isolated in a cell.
Yes, correct. There was another form here in San Francisco at the industrial schools called bucking and gagging, and that included putting a stick in a kid's mouth and then basically hog tying him and leaving him there for 2 or 3 days. And these were mostly kids who had not committed any crime. The most common reason for being committed to a 19th century institution was the offense called in danger of living an idle and dissolute life. And you'd had kids as young as 5 years old being committed to these institutions, including the industrial school, because basically they were seen as potential problems, if not now, later. They were wandering the streets. They were unsupervised. Parents were nowhere to be found. This is during the gold rush era. So the societal solution became to put them in an institution.
And you write how this often disproportionately affected girls, and that the choices for them inside these institutions were far fewer than that the boys had. So their plight in some ways was far worse than the boys.
Yeah, actually, that was there's always been a difference in how girls were treated within the juvenile justice system, and to some degree it continues on till today. But back in the 19th century, there were, first of all, a smaller number of girls held in institutions, and they tended to be held for things like incorrigibility.
Incorrigibility,
which
meaning?
meaning you talk back to your parents, and anyone who has a teenager, you know that that's going to happen. And so what often happened is, particularly with girls, there was always a fear that girls were going to go out, they were going to be promiscuous, they were to be the guardians of virtue. And so they needed special protection relative to the boys. So we would put them in these locked institutions. But at the same time, girls were not expected to be going out into the world and entering the workforce. That was a male thing. And so what could you prepare girls for? Well, you prepared them for two things: domestic service or marriage. And those were really the two things. And at the same time, you tried to really made a special emphasis to imbue them with religious concepts, because religion was seen, Christian values were seen as the path to virtue. So the treatment of girls was very different. And the girls were, you would find them, they would be the ones assigned to sweeping out the institutions when they were co-housed with boys. And they quickly learned that wasn't such a great idea. We ended up here in San Francisco in 1862, big scandal, massive sexual abuse of girls by the superintendent of the institution. And they moved them out and placed them in what became known as the Magdalen Asylum, which was located over on Potrero Street and was run by the Sisters of Mercy. And that became the alternative. And so that became the alternative for girls. But girls were always, throughout the 19th century, into the 20th century, were confined in institutions for less serious offenses than boys, and typically for longer periods of time.
And you write about a sort of cycle of reforms that then plant the seeds for new problems or perpetuate the same problems again and again and again. And you argue all the way really up to the present day, perhaps, you know, the problems aren't as large. You also talk about the reformers, and you talk about what you call child savers. And this is in the 19th century and into the 20th century. Right. Who were the child savers?
Well, the child those would we call today child advocates. And the child savers is actually a 19th century term. The great book written about them by Anthony Platt, a great scholar out of UC Berkeley from a number of years ago. But they were essentially the child advocates of the 19th century. Though they were the people that argued for more services, a broader responsibility by society for caring for the children who otherwise couldn't care for themselves.
But it would be the state's job to take control.
So initially, so it went through a number of phases. Initially, the child savers were, you know, private philanthropists and individuals working on their own private organizations. And the first institutions were established as private facilities. Then later, they were able to prevail and were able to advocate and get the state, initially the city of San Francisco and the state of California, to assume control over the institution, specifically the San Francisco Industrial School. And it was partly because they always suffered from inadequate resources, poor management. They were always embroiled in scandals. And so after a while, it forced the hand of the state, and the state stepped in. And in the case of the San Francisco Industrial School, had the city of San Francisco take over the institution from the organization that had been running it. It was run as a private institution.
And then well into the 20th century, through the 20th century, really, it's the continued growth of the state power and state institutions to deal with these kids, these young people. Yeah. I have to go into one thing, and it really is the most troubling part of your book. And it's you touch on one of the darkest chapters of state history, and that is the eugenics movement. And that is the idea that society can be improved by preventing some members of society from procreating, from having children. And this led to thousands of people in California and around the country forcibly sterilized. What I did not know until reading your book, is that this included children who were in state custody in these institutions.
Yeah. And actually, I want to give a shout out to there's a professor at UC Davis, Dr. Chavez Garcia. She wrote a book a number of years ago, the first one really detailing the eugenics practice within California's juvenile justice system, centered at the Whittier State School. Yeah, that was
How did it come about?
That was an ugly chapter. Well, first of all, it was the science of the day.
So it starts with intelligence testing.
Yes, 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 yes. And actually, the leadership around this was assumed by Stanford University. There was a professor down there by the name of Lewis Terman. Lewis Terman was one of the developers of the Stanford Binet IQ test, intelligence quotient test. Now, Alfred Binet, who was the French psychologist who originally developed the IQ test, did it for the purpose of trying to develop remedial educational programs, determining where kids are in school and developing remedial education programs. He didn't intend it as a measurement of intelligence. Terman did. And what Terman did is he believed that based upon your one-time score on an IQ test, on his test, that was the determining factor on what your overall abilities were. That was to be the determining factor on your level of intelligence.
And determining how you would fare the rest of your life.
Exactly. You couldn't grow. It was
locked in.
It was absolute. Yeah, your intelligence was locked in. And therefore, when applied to kids in reform schools, it had a disastrous effect.
We're talking the early part of the 20th century.
So what happens here is that, first of all, you have to understand the eugenics movement was considered a progressive movement at the time. It was well-funded. Partly, John D. Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie were pouring money into it. And in many ways, it justified the social structure, the existing social structure, the concentration of wealth. I mean, you can go into all the sociology of it. But so what happens is in 1912, Hiram Johnson is elected governor of California. Now, we all know Hiram Johnson is one of the great progressive governors in California history. And when Hiram Johnson was elected, he was confronted with this problem at the Whittier State School, one of the common scandals. He appoints one of his political supporters, a businessman by the name of Fred Nellis. Fred Nellis was a very charismatic, very able leader. And he went in, he was appointed superintendent of the Whittier State School, and he went in with the intention of reforming the school.
Always the case.
Always the case. And he was honest in his effort. One of the things that he fell under the spell of Terman. Terman had convinced him that if you're going to create this like a real, they wanted to make it like a real school. And so in order to make it like a real school, you had to get rid of the underperformers. And the underperformers, you would be able to determine based upon applying the IQ test. So Stanford University, in a partnership with the Whittier State Schools, they go down and they set up this office down at Whittier called the Office of Juvenile Research, was what it was called, Department of Juvenile Research. And they start applying IQ tests to all the kids that were coming in to the institution. And if kids fell below a certain level, if you were judged to be feeble-minded, that was the term that they used, then they shipped you off. Initially, they shipped you off to Sonoma State Hospital, and then later to the Pacific Colony, which is another institution they built down in the South. And there, once you were there, you had a choice. You could either ultimately, for many kids, the choice was you either agree to be sterilized, because California had a sterilization law. You could agree to be sterilized, or you could agree to remain institutionalized. And it was
your choice.
That was your choice. And so, many kids obviously did not want to remain institutionalized, so they opted for the operation.
At what ages are we talking about?
Oh, we're talking anything, 15 on up. I mean, it's hard. We don't really have accurate, we don't really have a lot of records of all the kids, but we have enough to know that it was falling between the ages of 14 and 18.
And how long did this practice continue? How many years?
Well, I think the law wasn't overturned until 72, but the eugenics practice really died out in the late. First of all, it started to die down at Whittier, which was the main center of it within the juvenile justice system in California in the 1930s because funding ran out. Then they tried to revive it, in 1937. And then when World War II came about, and then the atrocities that were associated with the eugenics practices by the Nazis, it died a quick death after that.
You know, you write in your book of some episodes that become scandals, some of the treatment, the corporal punishment over the years in the 19th century and early 20th century. Did this ever get any attention in the media? Was there ever any, in the years it was being practiced, any controversy over it?
Are we talking eugenics or just overall some of the abusive practices? Because abusive practices, if we're just talking the common beatings of kids and the methods in which the beatings were administered. I mean, that goes back to the earliest days of the first institutions, and it would come and abuses would be exposed and revealed at periodic intervals. Roughly,
but in terms of the eugenics and the sterilizations, not much.
No. Actually, not much had been written about it really until the end of the 1990s when Gray Davis issued an apology. But it was pretty much unknown within the juvenile justice system in California.
Well, we'll continue our conversation about juvenile justice in California and a sometimes troubling history with Dan McAleer after a short break. If you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Michael Montgomery, in today for Michael Krasny. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Montgomery, in today for Michael Krasny. We're talking with criminal justice expert and author Dan McAleer, talking about his book, which traces the history of youth corrections in California. We move into the modern era. The creation of the California Youth Authority blossoms under Governor Earl Warren. And really brings a new level of professionalism, of science.
Yes.
And I'm assuming at this point conditions start improving. I mean, the eugenics is done. They're not sterilizing children anymore, and they're not lashing them or hosing them down at this point. And we're talking about the 1940s and moving into the 1950s.
Right, right. Yeah, so it's important to note, one of the major reforms, probably the single most important reform era in California corrections history occurs in the 1940s. Up until this time, California had really been following the path blazed by other states. We adopted the institutions that were first established on the East Coast, and the practices were pretty much defined by, you know, what other people were doing, what other states were doing. And it really wasn't until the 1940s that California jumped out as the leader, at least on juvenile justice policy or juvenile corrections policy.
And of course, this was also happening in the adult sphere as well.
Yes.
Blossoming, and California really becomes a model for the rest of the country.
Well, so what happens is, first of all this is born on scandals, of course. And there's a major event at Whittier that occurs in August of 1939 with the death of a young boy, a 13-year-old by the name of Benny Moreno. And it occurred under very suspicious circumstances. It triggered a number of investigations. And it concluded in probably one of the most comprehensive investigations of institutional care in the state of California ever done, right up until today. And it was carried out by a judge by the name of Ben Lindsay. Now, Ben Lindsay was one of the most famous juvenile court judges of the early 20th century. He started off in Colorado, actually ended up moving to Los Angeles in 1937, got elected to the Superior Court. He was appointed by Governor
Governor. I'm forgetting it.
Prior to Earl Warren,
and he takes over this investigation.
Yes, and he takes. Yeah, so it actually, Benny Moreno's death occurs during his administration, and so there are these investigations that are launched, and it finally concludes with the Lindsay investigation. And the Lindsay investigation is a damning report. They went and they examined conditions not just at the Whittier State School. They went to the Ventura Girls School. There were three institutions at the time, the one school for girls, Ventura, and then Preston, which is on Ione, which was the school for older kids. And what they found was shocking. Horrendous conditions, systemic abuse, kids routinely being beaten, subject to beatings, staff inflicted, ward inflicted, just top down. And also their investigation looking at the suicide of Benny Moreno also found that there was a strong indication that it wasn't a suicide at all, that it was likely he was killed by a staff person using rabbit punches, which is what they used to use at the time.
And there's another death, more scandal, and it really moves things into this modern era of the California Youth Authority, which, just to fast forward a little bit through this, it becomes a real national model using the newest of science. And this is in parallel with the same thing happening with the California Department of Corrections. And you have this enormous institution that's created. When we moved through the 60s and 70s, and there are lots of experimentation going on, some of it very interesting, we get to a situation in the 70s, 80s, where it all just starts collapsing with overcrowded facilities, and it starts coming apart.
Well, I do want to clear – I think it's important to clear something, because this comes up a lot. The 1950s and 1960s are often looked on – with many people with a degree of fondness that this was kind of a golden age in juvenile corrections in California. It was not. And it's important, I think, to point that out. We have to separate out the rhetoric from the reality. What we had when Earl Warren became governor, Earl Warren came in with a real determination to create a model system, to reform corrections, youth and adult. And he appointed excellent people. The first head of the Youth Authority was a guy by the name of Carl Holton, who was a former chief probation officer in Los Angeles County. And then he was followed by Heman G. Stark. And then he was followed by Alan Breed. These were very, very able leaders and very visionary leaders and had a very very well-developed ideas about how institutions should be run. And they tried to institute reforms. And the big thing was to create specialized institutions that would treat, you know, specific types of kids, specific types of issues that would be identified at a diagnostic center where the kid would go when they first came in. This is the year of the youth authority. And so they would apply science in a way that had never been applied before. And they instituted a lot of new programs. They developed group therapy processes within the institutions. And that was all good. And there's no question in my mind that they were absolutely sincere in what they were trying to do. But they could never change the daily reality of life within the institution.
And that's part of your ongoing arguments,
yes.
Is that is almost an inevitable
yes.
consequence of this kind of institutionalized prison-like treatment or care. I think
that's the lesson of history so far.
We're talking to Dan McAleer, a criminal justice expert. If you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. I want to take our first caller, and this is Jane from Corte Madera. Jane, you are on forum.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I appreciate it. This is a fascinating subject that we really don't know about. And here in the United States, we're so busy talking about Ireland and how they treated all those people over there. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the movie Spotlight about the church. But the Rockefeller Foundation helped found the German eugenics program and even funded the program that Joseph Mengele worked in before he went to Auschwitz. You know, we don't know that stuff. We don't teach that stuff in school. But California was really the originator of this eugenics program, and they even had Harriman Foundation. They had local charities looking for Jewish people, Italians, and other immigrants, people who didn't look like us or didn't look like they would ever create future generations of intelligent, bright people that would be good for the rest of the population of our country. We're in it up to our necks with it, and we just don't talk about it.
Jane, thanks very much for your call. A couple of comments. Gina writes, understanding this history is extremely important, especially when it comes to countering the anti-psychiatry sentiments that claim Big Pharma invented childhood development disorders such as ADHD. I, for one, am greatly relieved that modern neuroscience can help these kids live out their potential instead of being held back by antiquated ideas about behavior and even worse ideas about youth corrections. Dante writes, my younger brother spent many years in and out of Sonoma County Juvenile Hall. One thing I remember was my parents getting large bills from the state. Can the speaker comment on the financing aspect? Is that still a common practice? Dan McAleer.
Yeah, actually, counties have the right to right now to bill you if your kid gets arrested and gets confined or detained in a local juvenile hall. They do have that option to bill you for that. Now, that came about. Actually, I should say that some of that came about as a result of parents abusing juvenile halls, because it used to be in the old days that parents who, you know, you're having an argument with your kid on a Friday night, you take the kid down to the local juvenile hall and tell them you can't handle the kid anymore. And the kid gets locked up for the weekend, then come back on Monday and say, you know, I've had a change of heart. I'd like to try again. And so that's kind of it was an abuse of the system. And so some of the fees that were attached were to discourage that. At the same time, I have to say that counties this is enforced. It's a county by county decision whether to enforce it, and some counties are probably more vigorous than others. And partly, it's a finance issue now.
And you talk a lot in your book about various treatment efforts, alternatives, and the caller mentioned the use of medications. What is your understanding of what kinds of treatments are being used in state facilities right now? This is the Division of Juvenile Justice. These are the few remaining facilities for youth offenders.
Yeah. The big issue around the use of medications in correctional facilities is, frankly, the issue has always been the misuse of them. is that too often and too frequently they've been used to control behavior to render the ward, which is the term they use, more manageable within the institutional setting, not necessarily addressing specific long-term behavioral issues. So a lot of times what you'd find is kids get prescribed or are given medications within the institutions. The parents have no – are not notified of it. The release date comes. Kid goes back home and he's suddenly off these medications and there's no record. There's no transitional period. It's not a good history. I think that there – and that's not to say that – I've certainly have traveled and toured, gone through the California institutions many times over the last 30 years, and I have to say that there are professional people, good people that work there that do the best job they can.
You know, there are a lot of other things have changed. There's been the role of brain science in really giving a deeper understanding of childhood trauma and how that connects to crime. There's been, that sort of contributed to shifting attitudes. You see sentencing reforms. People getting out on parole who were convicted as minors, have been in adult prison, getting out in part based on this brain science. Those are real things happening.
I'm not a big proponent of the brain science, to be honest with you. I think that certainly we know the impact of trauma and how that can impact a child's development. But the reality is when you go back in the history of the juvenile justice system, who ends up in institutions? It's the children who come from poverty. And the socioeconomic situation that they come from really determines whether or not they end up in the system or not. I've been working in the system for 30 years. And I've seen hundreds of kids, maybe thousands. I can think of maybe five kids that came from a middle-class background. So I'm cautious on a lot of the brain science stuff. I know it's popular right now, and I think that I don't know. I don't want to call it a fad. I think it's I think there's certainly legitimate science. I believe that our brains go through stages of cognitive development. We know that, but I don't think it's a determining factor as to whether kids end up in the juvenile justice system. I think it's the same old reason that it was back in 1825.
And we were talking earlier. You really believe that the counties should take over completely from the state. And that's happened, there's been a process that predates the Governor Brown's realignment, and that is the realignment of youth institutions and with the counties taking more and more of the job. And you say they should go all the way on that. People disagree with you. Fellow experts who have been on this program disagree with you.
Yep.
And they say California should develop high-tech institutions to deal with the toughest cases, the most violent offenders. There's a proposal to build, I believe, four new facilities.
Right.
And the bottom line is counties just sometimes can't deal with this, and especially some counties that are not well as equipped as others. And you have some real opponents on that.
Yes, I do. Look at one of the problems when we get into issues of juvenile justice reform, we tend to a lot of times the debates kind of center on the here and now. One of the things that prompted me to write this book is that I've been in these debates for more than 30 years now about how do we move forward, and it always has come down. The debates have always come down to we need to build a better institution. I don't know how many times I've been in meetings where people talk about we just need to build that better institution. And one of the things that prompted me to write this book is I wanted to look back and say why didn't they figure this out 100 years ago? And it turns out they did. We just never paid any attention to it, and we kind of go back to this debate every 30 years. Once these institutions were established, they have constituencies, and they kind of become the center of thought, and we really don't move outside the box. We have right now in the state of California 58 counties, and yes, it is very true that some counties have more resources than others. Some counties are better equipped, but if we're going to move juvenile justice forward into the 21st century, we've got to localize the treatment. What happens with kids who go into correctional facilities, they come back home And historically, there's no one back providing services to that kid when they come back home. There's no one dealing with the problems within the kid's home. No one dealing with the problem of the kids in the community or the neighborhood. If we keep the services at the local level, we're most served juvenile. 99% of juvenile justice services are delivered at the local level. I think it would take us one step further more comprehensive reform, and it'll eliminate this historic problem of operating a bad institutional system at the state level. The state has shown that it's had over 100 years to try, and it has shown it's not had the capacity to provide the kinds of services that kids actually need, and inevitably, they descend into these institutions, you know, corrupt and brutal and abusive institutions. We've got to stop that cycle.
I want to get to some of our calls. Romero in San Jose, you're on Forum.
Hello. Appreciate you taking my call. My son just turned 18 in June, and he was called in for questioning as a suspect in a carjacking. He had nothing to do the week before the person was caught red-handed with everything. So now he's in Merced County. That place is so corrupt. The DA and his wife run the judicial system when there's a conflict of interest in the public defender. So he has picked up another case while he was in there, and he's been exonerated from having any physical evidence that ties him to it. But my question is, like Connecticut, is California moving to move the age limit up higher, say 21 or 20? That would really help, I think, with our kids nowadays.
Thanks for your call.
Well, so historically, we've had the upper age limit of our youth correction system has been 25. And a couple years ago, it was reduced to 23. The experience with that has not been good, is that you end up putting young kids in facilities with older kids. And what happens is when you have these youth prisons, these young adult prisons, is they tend to be very violent. I mean, this was one of the experiments that was done under the Earl Warren administration, and they wanted to create a facility for a specialized facility for young males, and it was called dual vocational, and it turned into the most violent institution within the Department of Corrections and the California Youth Authority.
Another caller, Neil, you're on Forum. Neil is in San Francisco.
Yes. Is there any other country whose juvenile justice system could serve as a model for our own?
Dan
Meckler? I think if you look at a lot of certainly the European countries are some of the obvious places where people look. They incarcerate very few kids. And I think that if you look at any country, look at their rate of incarceration, and they're probably treating – if it's very low – they're probably treating kids better.
I do want to go back to this proposal, because you talk about this difficult age, young offenders, 18 to 22, 23. Part of this proposal to build new facilities would be specifically to deal with this age group and to not have them put in regular prisons.
Yeah.
And that is something you still oppose.
I've read that proposal, and it's flawed. It's a rebuild of the California Youth Authority. You look at they want to build four 300-bed congregate facilities, two of them at the old Preston site, which was one of the California old youth correctional facilities that were closed, and another one at the Ventura site. Those are three big 300-bed facilities, and I think in my book, I lay out – actually, I use a diagram of the proposed – facility, the diagram of the type of facility they're proposing, and I put it right next to a diagram of a proposed facility from 1890, and it's exactly the same. So it's not really doesn't really represent any kind of major change.
And yet the state has allocated up to upwards of $1 million to study this. I mean, they are taking it very seriously.
Right. So. Okay. Yeah, and it's the Department of Corrections, and again, it kind of represents. Not so much the interest of kids, but the interest of the bureaucracies that, you know, we set up to serve kids. And this is kind of a going back to what we've done in the past. And this is one of the things that concerns me, is that we seem to be going back to the same thing we did before. And we haven't heeded the lessons of history. And I think that this is an example of that.
But you and I have both seen some of these county facilities. There are some that are models mm-hmm. doing, you mentioned, I believe, Santa Clara,
yep.
Santa Cruz.
Yep.
Yep. But there are Good a systems. Lot of others that are not pretty places. And so you're saying yep. that young people facing longer sentences should be housed in these facilities that, you know, I mean, I just see lawsuits, more and more lawsuits, you know, against these counties as they handle these,
yeah,
these
and
offenders.
Yeah, and I'm fine with the lawsuits. If they're abusing kids, they should be sued. Yeah, and so, you know, my argument is that do we construct two bad systems or do we move towards a 21st century? Let's, you know, during my time that I've been in the field for 30 years here in California, we've always focused on the state systems. We've never really looked at the local systems. And what I think it's time that for 21st century reform should be focused on the local system. But we're never going to get there if we're continuing to fight the battle over how the state system should be structured, whether we should rebuild it, or if we rebuild it and we start to experience the same old patterns that we experienced before. Then we're back fighting kind of a two-front war. I think if we're going to move forward in the 21st century, let's move the resources to the counties. Let's establish a state body that oversees the counties, that provides direction, monitoring, funding for the development of model practices, and then put some enforcement there. Establish a statewide inspector general to ensure that kids are being treated at the local level. But let's continue the process that we began in the last 10 years. The counties will develop the capacity. I mean, nobody is going to innovate unless sometimes, unfortunately, counties can become very innovative when they're forced to. If they're not forced to, bureaucracies tend to fall back on old patterns. And I'm starting to see a little bit of that now. We're starting to see counties going back to committing kids to the state institutions. It's just kind of a trickle, but I'm getting a lot of calls on it now. And if that happens, we're going back to the old way.
Well, you know, Patricia writes, please ask Dan about the rise of children being tried as adults for capital offenses such as murder. Are you seeing an increase in that or direct commitments as well?
Well, so relative to 20 years ago, there's a dramatic decrease in the number of kids being transferred to the adult court. What happens now is prosecutors have the authority to direct file kids into the adult court. And in California, you have very different policies or practices county to county. And this is something I think we have to get to, is that some DAs will move to transfer kids to adult court. Other DAs won't. And it's a matter of which county you're in. It's justice by geography. And I think it's another argument that we make to focus reform efforts from here on at the county level, so we get the counties to develop the best practices. And it's not just what happens to you. The fate of a kid is not simply determined by their geographical location, what county they're in.
Another thing we haven't talked about is the cost. Last I checked, the cost per ward in the state facilities was upwards of $200,000 a year. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it's going to be $240,000 in this budget. And what we get for that, I don't know.
And you would argue it would be much cheaper to have these offenders being handled by the counties.
For $240,000, I'll house them at dorms over at San Francisco State or Stanford.
I want to go to another comment. Michael writes, congratulations, Dan, on your book. Yeah, I want to recommend a book by Dwight Abbott, I Cried, You Didn't
yes.
Listen,
yes.
which is an incredible expose of the California Youth Authority by one who was brutalized within its walls during the 1950s. We've barely touched on the Youth Authority
yes.
and really the earlier institutions. And like I said earlier, your book is really eye-opening in going through some of these scandals. And again, they repeat themselves again and again and again and well into into more recent times, which of course led the way to the Farrell lawsuit, which really did compel the state to make some changes.
Yes, yes.
In looking back in this long
history, I just want to point out Dwight Abbott, who he's referencing there. That was his experiences occurred in the 1950s and 1960s during the time of the reform.
So, who's the hero of your book? I know who the villains are, I think.
No, I think I came away with a good – I liked Alan Breed.
He was the director of
the California Youth Authority. Director of the Youth Authority under Reagan. And I think Carl Holton. And Ken Scudder, too. Kenyon Scudder during the early years in the 1920s. He was the he started off as working at Preston, then he became the superintendent at Whittier. And he tried to institute changes, ultimately was fired by the governor, former mayor of San Francisco, Sonny Jim Rolfe, unfortunately. But there were, there were people who really attempted to make some changes. Probably the biggest hero would be Ben Lindsay. I think his investigation and expose of conditions in the facilities in the 1940s, you rarely see someone an investigation that goes to that level.
Yeah, and the details again in your book are utterly riveting. No one today on your short list of heroes?
Oh, I think no. I think we've got excellent reformers: the prison law office, David Steinhardt from the Commonweal, Sue Burrell from the Youth Law Office, James Bell. We've got an excellent array of reformers here in in California. Books Not Bars over in Oakland. Great people doing great work.
All right, Dan McAleer, we'll leave it there. Dan McAleer is the author of After the Doors Were Locked, an excellent history of youth corrections in California. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lorberg, Judy Campbell, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Joanne Wallace. I'm Michael Montgomery, in today for Michael Krasny. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.